Welcome to NPR's Movie Podcast, a look back at all things film from NPR news magazines. This week, we hear about a new documentary film that redefines the term blacklist. An independent filmmaker is arrested by Chinese authorities while trying to film a protest during the Beijing Olympics. It was a bad summer for minorities in the summer's blockbusters. NPR Science Friday takes a look at technology and the movies. Do you remember Smell-O-Vision? But first, film critic Kenneth Turan gets a few laughs from Hamlet. No, not that Hamlet.
What can I say about Hamlet 2 that its title doesn't already tell you? This is an unhinged, off-the-wall comedy. Yes, it's uneven, but the hits are so dead-on that the misses don't seem to matter. Hamlet 2 comes to life because of the all-out performance of Steve Coogan as Dana, a high school drama teacher in Tucson who refuses to say die when his program is terminated. Instead, much to the astonishment of his wife, he decides to put on a play of his own.
Hamlet 2?
The deuce, correct.
Doesn't everybody die at the end of the first one?
It's about my troubled relationship with my father.
Dana brings the unstoppable enthusiasm of the Energizer Bunny to his love of acting and theater. Unfortunately, he's never been very good at either. The one bright spot in Dana's life is that he runs into his favorite actress of all time, Elizabeth Shue, deftly played by Shue herself, at the Prickly Pear Fertility Clinic.
I'm sorry to be so forward, but you look a lot like my favorite actress of all time, Elizabeth Shue.
Yeah, I am her.
I'm freaking out. You were wonderful in Leaving Las Vegas.
Oh, thank you.
So fabulously funny in Adventures in Babysitting, not forgetting Cocktail with Tom Cruise. What is he like? He seems totally great. What are you doing in Tucson? Oh, my God, I'm freaking out.
I'm actually a nurse now. I just, you know, got kind of sick of the business, you know? Sick of all the horrible people. And anyway, there's a real shortage of nurses out there, and I like taking care of people.
Oh, my God, I didn't hear anything you just said because I'm too excited.
Hamlet 2 picks up steam with the mounting of the show. For reasons that are never quite explained, how could they be? Hamlet 2, the play, has Jesus as a pivotal character. The show's main production number, Rock Me Sexy Jesus, is really something to see. When the father of one of the stars says, "I'm simultaneously horrified and fascinated," you'll know just what he means.
The blacklist once defined Red Scare communist investigations by the U.S. government in the 1950s. Now an HBO documentary is redefining that term. HBO's The Blacklist is a documentary with 22 prominent black Americans, from General Colin Powell to erotica writer Zane, having their say. Here are some voices from the film.
I learned that you can stand up for what you believe in and that people will come to respect that, even if they don't agree with you.
I think I've been true to my roots as far as what kind of guitar playing that it is that I do.
It's a lot more than just hitting the ball as hard as you can. It's all about strategy and moving your opponent and just really figuring them out. Like, I never get credit for mental.
I was studying to be an engineer and, you know, I'm going to drop out to become a stand-up comedian.
And as we were leaving the church, I said to my father, "Hey, Daddy, I'm going to be a lawyer like Thurgood Marshall."
Those were some of the personal reflections of former Planned Parenthood President Faye Waddleton, rock guitarist Slash, tennis star Serena Williams, comedian Keenan Ivory Wayans, and attorney Vernon Jordan. HBO's The Blacklist is the brainchild of director Timothy Greenfield Sanders and journalist Elvis Mitchell. I started off by asking Elvis Mitchell about the title.
As an African-American, you know this, right, that you hate that phrase and you hate any of the thing because so much of black culture is about reclaiming the negative. And I just thought, well, this is the 21st century. Why not come up with a blacklist that people want to be on, and a blacklist that celebrates that part of that word in it anyway? Because it just feels ridiculous to me that at this point still having a black mark or being called black-hearted or any of that kind of stuff is still considered to be, you know, derogatory. So why not use this as a way to sort of restart the conversation?
It seems to me that we're in a period of overall reevaluation of blackness, both whether or not and how it's subversive and whether or not and how it's powerful, because it's the year of Obama, some people say. Did that intersect at all? Did the political side intersect at all with your thinking about the timing of this project?
You know, we were before all of that. And maybe we can ride or see the zeitgeist, but this started 2.5, 3 years ago. Barack wasn't even running. There was no talk of that. So I think we just felt it was the right project to do. And for us, it was interesting. You know, we lucked out enormously. Here we are with the ultimate project at the perfect time.
Both of you use a pretty austere aesthetic in this, both visually and in terms of how the interviews were edited to excise the questions. Visually and verbally, why did you choose to do this the way that you did?
Well, for me, you see so many of these documentaries. There's a cut to, you know, the black guy in the tweed jacket wearing glasses and nodding sagely. And I don't own a tweed jacket. So for that reason alone, I couldn't be in it. But also, I just thought that I'm immaterial to it, that these are the stories of the subjects, not mine. We didn't need an audience surrogate. The people are talking to the audience. So why not just let them talk and tell those stories?
Some of the people you spoke to include Sean Combs, Richard Parsons, former Planned Parenthood President Faye Waddleton, Thelma Golden. How did you choose your subjects between you?
It was very much about not the usual suspects. We wanted a very diverse group of people. We didn't want just the obvious talent in African-American community of sort of musicians and sports figures. I mean, those are the easiest people to go to. So we wanted, you know, Faye Waddleton, who could talk about an extraordinary life and her experience, and Malin Duckett, who was an original Negro League player, and that was very important to us.
When Zane came up, my sisters went, "Ooh, y'all got Zane?"
Zane, for those who don't know, is what would you call her, an erotica writer? Incredibly, she's crossed over now into doing...
an extremely popular erotica writer who started off writing stuff on AOL and had her website shut down on AOL.
And tells that story in your doc. Well, let's talk about one of the people who some may be a bit surprised shows up at all, Slash, guitarist of Guns N' Roses.
Slash is in the movie? I need to see this.
Now, he talks about coming from a tradition of funk and R&B music, but here he is talking about One in a Million, a Guns N' Roses song that has some racial insensitivity, according to some folks. Let's take a listen.
As far as being black and, you know, being in Guns N' Roses, I think the only time there was a realization in the ethnic difference between myself and, say, Axl was when we put out this song called One in a Million that he wrote. The lyrics in it were, I can't even remember, it was just immigrants and faggots and police. And that was the first time that I was like, you know, I don't really feel comfortable with you making these statements. Suddenly, the fact that I was black became very apparent to people on the street. You know, a lot of black dudes would come up and go, why did you allow that to happen? So they all knew. I didn't really ever think about who thought where I was from that much.
Elvis, what did you like about... I mean, Slash is someone who, you know, this was the first time that I saw a picture of him with his mom, who's African-American. And I certainly remember when I found out Slash was black, biracial, whatever. You don't even actually ask him what he considers himself, but he talks about having deep connections with his African-American family. Why did you choose him for this project?
I knew from the outset that Slash is in this, and he was going to be the first person, because if it's not the usual suspects, if we don't want to feel like, and forgive me for saying this here at public radio, public television, if it's not going to be like a PBS documentary that runs in February during Black History Month and during the Pledge Drive, you want to send a shout across the bow that says this is different. And that when you think about black music, we don't tend to have any history. So people think, oh, it's got to be hip-hop. And people forget that we invented rock and roll. So why not have somebody who's still a practicing avatar with an enormous sphere of influence who's biracial? People, friends of mine, who are lifelong Guns N' Roses fans had no idea. And that's the one that, because for me, if you look at this film, I want people to be the equivalent of walking into a room and saying, wait, there's Slash, and there's Zane, and there's Dick Parsons, and there's Toni Morrison, and there's Colin Powell. What do these people have in common? And so what it is, as far as I'm concerned, it's the African-American experience in the 21st century, and that contains multitudes.
What about his interview surprised you, if anything?
Slash's interview?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think he was extremely open. I mean, Elvis really has a way to get people comfortable. And I think that was the magic of this film is that, you know, we combine kind of my portrait technique with Elvis's charm and his encyclopedic knowledge. So we sat there with Slash, and I think you see a side of him that you don't really ever see, and an openness and a kind of warmth. And even though he's wearing sunglasses the whole time, it's still you can feel him.
You having this as a project, there recently, of course, was the big CNN Black in America series. And, like, why the hilarity? Come on, spit it out.
Because, come on, girl. Now, don't make me do this on public radio. You know, we used to be ghettoized. Usually this kind of thing ran in February. And it was somebody saying, well, you know, we haven't answered any questions here today. But because – and it's thrilling because – we now have a serious contender for the office of president. This can now run in some month other than February, but still have the same kind of, well, I guess we haven't solved any problems here today, or this issue is still here with us. I didn't want to do a film that was about black victimhood, that was about black people not being able to get through a competently managed day, because that's what you'd think if you look at documentaries, if you look at Black in America. It's still this kind of, you know, wringing of hands and furrowing of brows. And why not make a film that's unsentimental about people having pleasure in their success?
Well, that's a great note to end on. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you so much. It's really a pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
We've been talking with director Timothy Greenfield Sanders and journalist Elvis Mitchell. They're the masterminds behind the film, The Blacklist, and they joined us at our studios at NPR West. HBO's The Blacklist airs on Monday, August 25th.
This is Day to Day. I'm Alex Chadwick.
I'm Madeline Brand. In Beijing, the Olympic flame has been extinguished. The athletes have gone home, and so have some people who were arrested and imprisoned for protesting.
One of them, American independent filmmaker Tom Grant. He went to Beijing at the end of July, a few weeks before the Olympics began. He was there to document a group called Students for a Free Tibet as they were attempting to demonstrate during the Games. Instead, he was arrested and repeatedly interrogated, and then he was sent to a detention center for 5 days.
Tom Grant is now back in New York, where he spoke with me earlier today about his ordeal.
We were being told to disrobe, put on red shorts, red shirts, going through metal detectors several times, and then brought up to a second floor, me along with two other people that were detained, actually James Powderly and Jeffrey Ray, the two people I was apprehended with to begin with. Brought down this long corridor, and next thing I know, they're opening one door and basically pushing Jeff into it. And I noticed there were about 12 people all in the same uniform laying down on these wooden cots, you know, for lack of a better term. And at that point, it sort of dawned on me, like, oh, I'm being put into general population.
With Chinese nationals.
We were separated into separate cells, and it seemed like throughout all the cells, it was evenly split between Chinese nationals and foreign nationals.
And did you know for how long you would be detained at that point?
No, I had no idea. No information was being given to us. Basically, we were just like, go into the cell. We had two mealy blankets given to us, and we had to put that down in the wooden flats and essentially try to get some sleep.
So for 5 days, what happened?
The next day, 6:30 wake up, within a half hour, I was brought down to a smaller cell and put into this very Orwellian chair, called stainless steel with a rib strap, metal strap I was chained into. On the other side of the cell were the uniformed police officer I recognized from the night before and the interpreter.
And they questioned you?
They questioned me every single day from periods of 6 hours to 12 hours.
What did they ask you?
Essentially, what I was doing in Beijing, who I was working for, the techniques that we were using to capture the images, how we were distributing them, what our motivation was, who the people we were in contact with, who organized all of these events, and how we got information to go to these events and what to do with the media afterwards.
Were you asked for and did you give any names of Chinese nationals or Tibetans?
I was constantly asked names of people I was in contact with. Throughout the time, we mostly used pseudonyms and we used SMS services such as Twitter to communicate. At that point, I mostly just knew code names, and that's all I gave them. Eventually, they grilled us further and further and further, and we gave up some names that we knew, and mostly that was just first names.
So are you worried at all that now these people will be imprisoned and subjected to, well, to far worse treatment than you were subjected to?
I gave no names of Chinese nationals or Tibetans that are within the country. Let me back up a little bit. 2 days into the process, we were woken up at like 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, brought down to these cells, shown these papers that were all written in Chinese pinyin, and told loosely that we were being sentenced to a 10-day detention and that we had to sign the statement and give our fingerprints in red ink.
So you don't know what you signed?
No. Every statement I wrote at the bottom, I do not read Chinese. This was translated to me orally.
When were you released?
We were released the afternoon of the 24th of August, actually about a half hour before the closing ceremonies began.
And then what happened?
We were driven very, very slowly to the airport.
And put on a plane and off you went?
Well, we stopped at the airport, and next thing we know, we were told that we were being charged for our flights home, something the American Embassy said was probably not going to happen. The next thing we know, they had taken all of our Chinese currency, our renminbi, and at the same time taken our credit cards, and they began swiping our credit cards and charging us to the flights.
So what about all the stuff that you brought, all the video equipment?
At the airport, as they were processing our credit cards, I was told that all the items I brought in were illegal and were being seized. $10,000 worth of equipment.
Well, given what happened to you, given the fact that you weren't able to complete filming your documentary, would you have done anything differently? Would you have done it all over again?
I'd do it in a heartbeat.
Well, Tom, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
No, thank you.
That's American Tom Grant. He joined us from New York. He spent 5 days in a detention cell in Beijing during the Olympics.
Many things have changed about race relations since 1948. One thing that has changed is the portrayal of African Americans in the movies. Or maybe not. Here's screenwriter and Morning Edition commentator John Ridley.
Well, that's it. Summer's about over. Hope yours was good. How was mine? Thanks for asking. Well, I'm not given to absolutes, so I'm going to say, in terms of what Hollywood gave us, this was just the dimmy most offensive summer ever at the multiplexes. Offensive, if you happen to be a person of color, which Hollywood in turn mocked, lampooned, or humiliated, that is, when we weren't just being completely ignored. There was Jack Black supplying the voice of a Chinese bear in Kung Fu Panda. I guess the producers of the movie thought it would be all right for an Occidental to voice one of the most revered symbols of China, since they gave actual Asian actors Jackie Chan and Lucy Liu all of, like, 5 lines in supporting roles. We had Mike Myers entertaining himself by flogging Hindu and Indian stereotypes, and the lovely Jennifer Hudson playing a 21st century Hattie McDaniel to the Sex and the City gals. Excuse me, Jennifer's the one with the Oscar. Shouldn't they be fetching Jennifer's coffee? Yes, there was Will Smith as a superhero, an alcoholic, abusive, foul-mouthed superhero, and yes, there was redemption at the end of Hancock, but the path was so coarse as to be unsuitable for my kids to watch, so the only hero of color they saw this summer was The Incredible Hulk, which, by the way, why does a movie with nary a minority in it have to end with the Hulk destroying Harlem? Honestly, this summer's offerings couldn't have been any more offensive if they had released the director's cut of Birth of a Nation on Blu-ray. Out of 36 films put into wide release between May 2nd and August 22nd, only 4 had minorities in leading roles. In fact, the 2 performances that really stand out in big summer Hollywood films are Michelle Yeoh in The Mummy, she manages to bring grace and gravitas to every performance, and Robert Downey Jr. playing a white guy playing a black guy in Tropic Thunder. Sorry, but that one passes the funny test. It was funny! What can I tell you? Now, maybe you think this is just complaining to complain, but remember, this is the summer that featured Tiger Woods gutting out one of the greatest performances in sports history on a shattered leg, China having its coming out party with the Beijing Olympics, and Barack Obama making history in Denver. Now, I know truth is stranger than fiction, but when did reality become more fantastic than fantasy? So to all of my dear, dear friends in Hollywood, particularly those who can greenlight, Maybe before you finalize next summer's slate of films, it's time to put down your trade papers and pick up some real newspapers.
From NPR News in New York, this is Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. What does it take to make Batman fly or toys tell a story? Remember Smell-O-Vision? Special effects are as old as the movie industry, and this hour will go behind the scenes of cinema to learn about technologies that have revolutionized the silver screen. No 3D glasses required. Let's go to the phones, to Terrence in Gaithersburg, Maryland. Hi, Terrence.
Good afternoon.
Hi there.
In about the year 2000, a special effects artist told my alma mater that the next frontier, the final frontier, was rendering realistic-looking humans. And I know that there's some with computers. I know there's some resistance now, you know, with Beowulf and films like that. But I was wondering if Hollywood actually wants to continue going in that direction, or they just want to, hire big-name actors and just stand in front of a green screen all day.
Good question. Is it cheaper to make all these computer-generated, because we're seeing so many more of them, than hire the actors?
Well, there may be an actor strike coming up soon, so I think having those computer-generated characters waiting in the wings for their star turn might not be a bad idea, and maybe that's part of the motivation, is that actors can be temperamental. Sometimes you have to persuade them to come out of the trailer. Computer-generated characters, they're always ready, and they say the lines you give them. They don't try to change it. I don't really understand. I mean, I know that for graphics people, they just had the big computer graphics conference a week or two ago in Los Angeles called SIGGRAPH, and they're always trying to make humans on the screen look more realistic, and there's this phenomenon called the Uncanny Valley where... Have you seen a movie like Beowulf? There's a little bit of creepiness still because it looks human, but then it's kind of got a little bit of plasticity to the skin, or it's a little bit robotic in the movements, and you just don't buy it. And that's why I think Pixar has been so successful, by sort of keeping that, very stylistic, cartoony look. And, you don't expect the characters in Ratatouille or WALL-E to look, precisely human.
But the sets are all painted now, I mean, even on television, HBO series, like Rome, things like that, they make this huge, all the sets are just painted on in the screen there.
And there's just a difference. I was really mesmerized by the John Adams miniseries on HBO and the way that
right.
they could create those
exactly.
environments of colonial America. But, that's a background, and you don't subject it to the same scrutiny that you do an actor in the foreground where you say, is that a human or is it not? I think, you can do a great sailing ship. You can do a great 18th century building with computers. But I'm not sure, I sort of agree with the caller that I don't think computers are there yet in terms of believable humans. And I don't know if I would put money on them getting there. Mm-hmm. I hate to say in our lifetime, because then I'll sound like I'm I'm retrograde. But, let's say the next 10 years, that's still going to be a goal on the horizon.